Taping, might as well roll. My name is Joe Jordan. I work at NASA Ames Research Center, which is down in Mountain View, California. Actually, the first job I had there was on a big airplane with a telescope mounted on board for doing infrared astronomy. Actually, I got a picture of the airplane on this shirt here. In case you're wondering what all this is just sort of some of the mechanism for the telescope. There was a hole cut in the fuselage right there, and this chamber was isolated from the rest of the plane, because obviously you get very low pressures at 45,000 feet. You don't want that in the rest of the plane. But the thing was open to the atmosphere, and it was looking at things like stars in the process of being born, which emit in the infrared, invisible part of the spectrum, because they aren't, you know, they are born. We'll learn about this on Star Walk sometime this week, but stars tend to form from big clouds of dust and gas called nebulae, which collapse under the force of gravity over eons until they finally get tightly enough compressed that they start glowing with thermonuclear reactions. But before then, they just get kind of infrared warm, and you can study them with, you know, high-altitude balloons or satellites or airplanes like this one. This is one of only about one or two in the world that are flying observatories for infrared astronomy. What I do there now is work on the ozone problem in the stratosphere, also involving airplanes. We fly experimental, well, research aircraft around through the polar regions and other places, probing the current status of the atmosphere and trying to figure out what's going on. Also, I use the supercomputers, which is one of the main things at Ames Research Center. You know about the Kennedy and Johnson Space Flight Centers at NASA. Well, the Ames has the world's fastest supercomputers, and we use those for doing atmospheric modeling calculations. And some of these airborne expeditions, I've got some footage of on a video, which towards the end, I guess, or maybe halfway through, we'll take a look. It's only about an 8-minute thing, but it'd be a nice review of whatever we talked about ozone. Let's see. I guess, the talk today is about troubled skies, ozone depletion, and global warming, or the greenhouse effect. So it may sound like it, but I'm not actually here today to bring you a message of gloom and doom, except to say that the ultimate fate of the Earth is that it's going to end up totally fried. I mean, whether or not you believe in the ozone hole and the greenhouse effect, in about somewhere around 5 billion years from now, our sun is going to enter the red giant phase of its stellar evolution and start a swelling expansion, which will eventually envelop the Earth and most likely vaporize the whole thing. But maybe we should talk about the shorter term and more immediate problems here. It is interesting, though, to think about this, just sort of for a retreat, spiritual reflection aside here for a moment. You know, what is mankind going to do, you know, in that really long term? It's fun to think about, well, where are we going to go, or who, for that matter, will we or they be 5 billion years from now? If you think about it, we're about maybe halfway through the Earth's life now. You know, the Earth and the solar system have been around for about 4.5 billion years, and maybe we've got another 5 billion before all hell literally breaks loose. And so mankind now is only the product of a few million years of evolution from what we consider pretty low-level life forms, and we still got billions of years to go. And it's interesting to imagine what man might be like. For one thing, evolution, biological evolution, well, might it have stopped because we, with our artificial environments, have largely walled ourselves off from the need for vigorous interaction with nature, which typically drives evolution? Well, maybe not. Maybe we'll evolve to, you know, have the typical big brains and, you know, mostly a thinking type lifestyle that, you know, the aliens and science fiction have and all that. Who knows? It could well be that humankind, will be some kind of a hybrid with extremely sophisticated, complex, delicate, exquisite machinery and biological. I mean, if you think about it, really, biological substance and brains have some things in common with machinery. It's amazingly marvelous machines. One thought that has been recurring to me a lot lately is, you know, when you think about the extremely complex and delicate machine that the body is, in normal machines, how often they break down. I mean, you know, we get sick, but we get well, and it's just incredible to me how finely tuned our machines are. But anyway, maybe it'll be something more like what we consider a hybrid of a human being and a machine, but there's always still that heart and spirit there. And, the question is, how do we get there from here? Hopefully that heart and spirit will carry us through the more immediate difficulties. It's also neat to try to imagine, okay, well, what will be the main pursuits of humankind in the far future? Let's see. Certainly, it's obvious to me that our energy, at least until the sun becomes overbearing, will be mostly from the sun. In fact, it's probably all it will have eventually. And I talked a little bit about this Monday. And you know, if you realize that sooner or later we're going to be getting all our energy from the sun. And I don't mean just by sunlight shining on solar cells making electricity or shining on panels to heat water. I mean, you know, you can derive hydrogen fuel from sunlight, and with hydrogen you burn that, you get water, clean water as the exhaust, and it's a virtually limitless supply. You can make hydrogen from water using electric current generated by sunlight, and so on. All kinds of ways in which our energy will come from the sun. And what was I leading here to? Oh, so why not start now? If that's our ultimate direction, why not get on with it now? What else would humans be doing, or whatever humans become in the far future? Well, you know, gardening and things like that might be a large part. You can think of what our economy will be. What do people do to make money now? It's kind of interesting to reflect on what drives the economy now. A lot of it is sort of toys and nonsense. Machines will probably be doing most of the grunt work, except where people want to still do ancient crafts and arts. I think probably the main thing that makes money in the far future will be arts, entertainment, and exploration, learning and teaching, caring for, exploring, and celebrating the world and each other. We got to figure out how to get there from here, and we have to take a serious look at what we're up against, some of the problems that are more immediate now in the atmosphere. There is another one, well, another activity which humans will most likely be doing, and this is one of my favorites since I love astronomy. It will be not only just a scientific pleasure pursuit and sort of an intellectual curiosity, but it will be a vital necessity that we survey the skies and keep our eyes on the skies. Now, why would that be vitally necessary? Anybody think of any reason why that will be an essential part of at least some aspect of the economy? That'll keep at least a few people employed, because there are other threats from the skies besides the sun that'll get us before the sun, almost certainly. They may not get the entire Earth, they probably won't get the entire Earth, but they will get major parts of the Earth, unless we do something about it. What am I thinking of here?
Asteroids?
Yeah. Impacts from, you know, other bodies out in outer space. It's happened in the past, happens roughly every few hundred million years. That's not very long in the geological time scale. You know, you could say we're even due for one now. I mean, 60 million years ago, it seems that a giant impact wiped out a good bit of at least the higher life forms on the Earth. Not by directly squishing all the dinosaurs, but by throwing up all kinds of stuff into the atmosphere, which shaded the Earth and made it very dark and cold for a long time, cut off the light to the lower parts of the food chain, and, you know, really disrupted the ecology. This will happen again, although we do now begin to have the technology to be able to detect such things in advance and possibly ward them off. It's going to take a commitment to do that. Might be a wonderful use for nuclear weaponry. Although you got to be careful. You don't want to blow these things to smithereens, which will actually increase the probability of getting hit by a fragment. You got to do it carefully, and there's actually starting to be at NASA and in other places now some interesting discussion about this whole issue. And is it worth spending money on it? Well, you all will have to decide things like this sooner or later. To the immediate. Let's see, I don't want to do this. Too much to talk about. I basically want to sort of let your discussion guide this eventually, and, you know, remind me of all the things I know I'm going to forget to say. Maybe I should just compare and contrast these two problems. Oh, well, yeah, I should say that if you want more details, obviously I can't do as much in one session on both of these problems. They are two very separate problems, the ozone depletion in the stratosphere and the greenhouse effect or the global warming. 2 years ago, I came here and taught and did a separate session on each one, and I haven't checked, but I'm sure there probably are still tapes in the library, and, you know, if you're really interested, I've listened to those recently, and they were pretty good, and they have a lot of details and interesting discussion in there. I went through a whole bunch of equations and things and animated them, and we had a pretty good time, and also just, you know, talked about in very common sense terms what it means to us. Let's see. So those tapes are there for details on those. And we'll get into a little bit of that today also. But let's just start with the fact that these two problems are literally at opposite ends of the spectrum. There are some commonalities. I'll compare and contrast them here. They both involve the interaction of air and light. Okay? Now, by air, I mean in particular gases that humans are putting into the air. Different gases are involved in the two problems, although there is one, about really only one significant connection between the two problems, and that is that one kind of gas is involved in both problems. The CFCs, which are kind of notorious, the chlorofluorocarbons and halons, man-made chemicals which cause the ozone depletion, in concert with various natural processes, but those natural processes alone most certainly would not do what we're doing to the atmosphere without the man-made chemicals. Those same chemicals, the CFCs and halons, are also very potent greenhouse gases, absorbers and re-emitters of infrared radiation, which contribute to the greenhouse effect, the global warming that we're worried about. So that's the connection between them. As far as light, let's talk just a little bit about light and what I mean. What do I mean? These two problems are opposite ends of the spectrum. The sun, you know, we talk about solar energy Monday. That's mostly involving the visible light that we get from the sun. That's only a small part of the entire spectrum of electromagnetic radiation that comes in from the sun. There are far more invisible colors of light than there are visible. The shortwave, high-frequency end of the spectrum, we have ultraviolet, we have X-rays, we have gamma rays. On the long-wave, low-energy end of the spectrum, we have infrared, we have microwave, we have radio waves. In between there, in a narrow range that our eyes happen to be tuned to, we have the visible frequencies, visible wavelengths of light. In particular, what we're concerned about is the infrared, just beyond the red on the low energy side, and the ultraviolet, just beyond the violet on the high energy side. The ozone problem deals with ultraviolet, has to do with ultraviolet. The greenhouse effect has to do with infrared. Okay. How does this work? Let me just give you a, see if we can run through a quick, hard summary of how these things work. What is ozone, first of all? It's a special form of oxygen. The oxygen that we breathe is molecules containing two atoms of oxygen, O2. Ozone is O3. It's a relatively unstable molecule. It has three atoms of oxygen in it. Now, both ozone and oxygen protect us from harmful ultraviolet radiation from the sun. You know, you get a little bit of ultraviolet, you get a tan, maybe a sunburn, not, doesn't seem to be too bad. There is a sort of a range of ultraviolet wavelengths, and fortunately the highest energy part of that range we never see down here. It never reaches the ground, because if it did, it would fry us in a minute. And that's what we're protected from by the oxygen, the regular old O2. We're not worried about, you know, losing our oxygen, at least not yet, so there's no crisis about that. But then we're protected from a different band of the ultraviolet, slightly different energy range, by the ozone. Both of these protect us by being split apart by photons. Light is in particles called photons, which act like waves, so you can think of it either way. It's a kind of a paradox of quantum theory. But a hard ultraviolet photon comes in, splits apart an oxygen molecule into two separate O's. And then one of those O's can run around and recombine with another O2 out here, and you get an ozone. But then another, maybe less energetic, because it's ozone's easier to break up, it's less stable, photon of ultraviolet can come in and split apart the ozone into an O and an O2. And these things are always, this ozone is always being naturally created and destroyed by the sunlight. It's like a bucket that you're pouring water into at the same rate that a hole has water leaking out. What happens to the water level in that situation? Stays the same. If you keep pouring it, so the sun here is our water source of ozone, and the hole is the natural destruction process, also due to sunlight. What humans have done is tantamount to punching an extra hole in the bottom of a bucket, so that the water or ozone is leaking out a little faster than it can be replenished by the sun. And one of the common questions I get asked is, can't we just make more ozone up there, or can't we just well, how about just pumping all that extra ozone you hear about during the smog alerts in L.A., you know, pump that up there. Well, here's a point you should make whenever you hear that one proposed, is that even the smoggiest, most ozone-polluted days in L.A. only involve about a few percent of the concentrations of ozone that you need naturally up in the stratosphere. So even if you could succeed in pumping the ozone from the lower atmosphere up in the upper atmosphere, all you do is dilute the stratosphere's ozone. So what we would need for making enough ozone to restore the natural balance up there is an energy source comparable to the sun, basically. And humans aren't going to duplicate that. So what we need to do instead is concentrate on plugging that extra hole in the bucket. And the way we have punched the hole in the bucket and the way we need to plug it involves two elements mainly, chlorine and bromine. And these are carried aloft in a number of ways. And, you know, another question is commonly asked is, what about volcanoes? They obviously shoot a whole lot more stuff, a lot more powerfully, higher into the stratosphere than any little spray cans or refrigerators or, you know, that humans come up with. Well, that's true, except that the chlorine that volcanoes do produce prodigious amounts of is in the form of hydrogen chloride, which for one thing is quite soluble. And volcanoes also produce a lot of water, which they shoot up into the stratosphere, which promptly washes the chlorine back right into the lower atmosphere. You don't get very much chlorine into the stratosphere where the ozone is, where you need it for this rapid ozone destruction from volcanoes. The oceans are full of chlorine too, NaCl, salt, and salt water. Some of that makes its way into the stratosphere. There is a natural background level of chlorine in the stratosphere. However, 4/5 of the chlorine that is now in the stratosphere is of human origin. So we are dwarfing the effects of nature just with our little artificial chemicals here. And with bromine, it's even worse. And bromine is an even more virulent destroyer of ozone. And I could go through the whole series of reactions here, maybe later, how this all works. But the trick is, the important thing to realize is that, okay, how have we dwarfed the natural effects? What we have done is we have invented chemicals never before seen by the world until 1928, which can care. They are so inert, they don't react with anything. Nothing happens to them, and they eventually they float around, and they eventually, with the vertical mixing in the atmosphere, make their way into the stratosphere, carrying these chlorine and bromine atoms up there. But those atoms aren't going to do anything until they get separated from these molecules. Does anybody know how that happens? They get up there, way up, even above the ozone layer, until something attacks them and breaks off the chlorine and the bromine. That something is the ultraviolet radiation from the sun. It'll split off a chlorine and a bromine atom from these complicated molecules. Those then go rampaging around through the ozone like a Pac-Man. One chlorine atom can gobble up 100,000 ozone molecules, typically in a chain reaction where it just keeps coming back for more. Same with bromine, until maybe finally it runs into a hydrogen and returns to the earth in rain or something. So that's the trick. You know, it's very surprising. People will say, you know, I just don't understand how we can be doing it. That's how it's done. It's with these very inert, special artificial molecules that carry this stuff way up into the stratosphere, which even powerful natural processes don't typically do. They don't get it. They get plenty of it into the atmosphere, but they don't get it into the stratosphere very much. Okay, so now, let's see. So we're going to have less ozone. I guess I explained already that the idea is that ozone and oxygen, no, I didn't. They protect us from ultraviolet. How do they do that? By getting split apart by these ultraviolet photons and thereby absorbing the energy of those ultraviolet photons, which otherwise would have come down and fried us. So that's how they protect us from ultraviolet. They would have come down here and played havoc with living systems, but instead the oxygen and the ozone protect us from them by absorbing their energy. But if we're not worried about losing oxygen, we are worried about losing ozone, and it protects us from a certain band of the ultraviolet that the oxygen doesn't protect us from. It's the somewhat weaker ultraviolet, which isn't strong enough to break apart oxygen and thereby be absorbed by it, but it is strong enough to break apart ozone. So if we have less ozone up there now, there will be more ultraviolet coming through. Okay, now, if you have any questions at any point,
Suppose there was no ozone, and this weaker ultraviolet comes through. What happens when it doesn't it run into the O2 at all, or does it just bounce off the O2, or just go right through it?
Or you know, doesn't get scattered. It could get scattered in various directions, but it doesn't break apart the O2. So let's now go to contrast with how the infrared radiation works and the greenhouse effect. Just want to give you a little, you know, we can get into the controversy, and I'm kind of interested in what you all are hearing out there in the media and by word of mouth about, you know, is it really as bad as they say? And, you know, it's just a bunch of environmentalists trying to, you know, foist their agenda on people, and they're guilty about civilization in its profligate ways, and they want us all to, you know, sacrifice and scrimp and save and suffer. And so, you know, that's what all this legislation about controlling, you know, pollutants is all about. I just want to hear what people are hearing out there. We can get into that, but I want to give you a little bit of grounding in the science of how it works. And, well, it's kind of fun, I think. With the greenhouse effect, let me see if I can quickly describe what goes on with infrared. Now, when we talk about global warming, we don't mean that the whole world is warming up. I mean, it sounds like it from the term. The greenhouse effect, where does that name come from? Well, greenhouses, how do they work? Well, one way that they work is they let in, their glass is transparent to visible light, it lets it through, but then that same glass is somewhat opaque to the infrared, invisible light, that is re-radiated by the plants and the ground inside the greenhouse. It absorbs the visible light, heats things up, and that heat then is re-radiated as infrared, which doesn't get outside the glass, so it gets trapped in there. So then you get, you know, you get the new incoming visible light plus old recycled infrared light that keeps rattling around inside the greenhouse, and it piles up and heats up. Now actually, the main reason why greenhouses work is it doesn't even have to do with that. It's just because it keeps a confined mass of air isolated from wind currents and things, which could cool it off and refresh it. That's one of the main reasons why greenhouses work, is just by, you know, keeping the air there confined. But you get the idea with the greenhouse effect. Now, here we are. Here's the Earth. This is that the astronomical symbol for Earth. And we've got all this incoming solar radiation. Lots of invisible light of all these wavelengths I talked about, but plenty of visible light too. And the Earth has to somehow either reflect away all this light. It does reflect away a fair amount of it. The clouds and the oceans reflect away a good bit. But what about the light that's not reflected? It's absorbed. Well, what's going to happen if it's absorbed? It better be re-radiated after it's absorbed. Typically when light is absorbed, it's then re-radiated, usually at a different frequency, lower energy, like infrared. If it's not absorbed, what's going to happen to the Earth? I mean, if it's not re-radiated, what's going to happen to the Earth? It's temperature. If it keeps absorbing light and doesn't re-radiate, the Earth's going to heat up, right? If it brings in more than it dumps back out to space, it's going to heat up. So the Earth as a whole, as long as the temperature of the sun stays constant, the Earth is going to be at some level of thermal equilibrium, where it's going to be re-radiating as much as it receives from the sun, maybe at different wavelengths. And you think, well, now, wait a minute now. Didn't I say infrared is a lower energy kind of light than the visible light that's coming in? How can it maintain a balance? How can it re-radiate as much as it receives in if it's re-radiating at lower wavelengths? Does anybody have any idea on that? It has to do with the fact that it's only receiving light on this half from the sun, but it can re-radiate over here on the night side too. And the Earth is spinning all the time. So it's always, at any given time, only receiving visible light on one side, but it's re-radiating at lower energies, but all over the entire Earth. And so the Earth manages to maintain a balance with the incoming radiation from the sun by doing this. Now, I have to tell you that, related to this long-term astronomical scenario I talked about at the beginning, the sun's temperature is slowly creeping up, and it has been for billions of years. And eventually, even long before it swells up and engulfs the Earth, it will probably drive most of the water out of the Earth's atmosphere. And we'll have problems somewhat before 5 billion years, maybe 3.5, 4 billion years. But anyway, but for the time being, we can just consider the sun's temperature as pretty much constant enough for this discussion, okay? Now, if you don't believe in the greenhouse effect, you will in the next 60 seconds, because I'm going to tell you something that is very important to realize. That is that there already is a natural greenhouse effect that is recognized by everyone, even the most skeptical scientists that the media seem to give a lot of play to, and that is due to the atmosphere of the Earth. If the Earth did not have an atmosphere, we would now be 50 degrees colder than we are. The oceans would not be liquid. The oceans would be frozen if they even existed at all. So the current temperature of the Earth is 50 degrees higher than it would be without an atmosphere because of a greenhouse effect due mainly to water vapor. 80% of the natural greenhouse effect is due to the water vapor in the atmosphere. So let's see how this works a little bit here. Let's just imagine first the Earth with no atmosphere, as I've drawn here. And I guess we already talked about the concept of the thermal balance. All right, so it's re-radiating as much as it receives. Now, just for purposes of discussion, let's suddenly slap an atmosphere, a natural atmosphere with lots of water vapor on the Earth, okay? Maybe there's a little bit different colors here. I mean, this happened really very slowly. It evolved, and the atmosphere's changed a lot of its composition over billions of years. But let's just slap an atmosphere on there with water vapor. Forget about these noxious gases or whatever that humans are putting in there. Just the natural greenhouse effect. What would happen if you just suddenly put that there? Well, here's what would happen. The ground would now temporarily be taken by surprise because it's not only receiving the incoming visible light, but, okay, it re-radiates it as infrared, But now, these gases in the atmosphere, water vapor is a very efficient greenhouse gas, an infrared absorber. It absorbs, it's transparent like the greenhouse. It's transparent to the visible light, but it's somewhat opaque to the infrared light. Doesn't let all of it back out to space. It lets some of it back out. So it re-radiates. Some of it gets back out to space, but some of it gets re-radiated back to the ground. You know, a molecule here, a molecule here, a molecule here, they will absorb this outgoing infrared and re-radiate it in all directions, including back to the ground. So now, I guess the simplest way to draw this, the picture I have in my mind is this kind of thing. You've got incoming light, but in addition to that, at any given instance, you've also got old light, recycled light, that's been rattling around, exchanging between the lower atmosphere and the ground. So it is a fact that right now, the ground is actually receiving more radiation than it re-radiates away. Now, that's just the ground and the lower atmosphere that we're talking about. The Earth as a whole still manages to keep in balance. Well, now, how is that if the ground is actually receiving more radiation than it's radiating away? Well, what happens when it receives more radiation than it's radiating away? It heats up. And what happens when it heats up? It starts radiating away even more. The amount of radiation that something emits depends on its temperature. So as it heats up, it radiates away enough more that it can now get enough more through the atmosphere. There will still be plenty rattling around in here, but it now is at a higher level of output of re-radiation to get enough out to balance the solar input. But it had to raise its temperature to do that. And that's what global warming is all about. The lower atmosphere and the ground heat up because of this trapping of infrared by these infrared opaque gases. And at the same time, though, the stratosphere cools off. This is something that's not too widely appreciated. See, the ground and the lower atmosphere will heat up, but the stratosphere will actually cool off. And this is a critical connection, actually, to the ozone problem because, well, let's get into this in a minute. Well, all right. You may wonder, well, why is the ozone problem so bad at the poles? Why are we getting these ozone holes over the poles when we're emitting, supposedly, these chemicals here, you know, in the industrial areas of the world? The basic answer, and it's a very good question, the basic answer is that these chemicals get distributed throughout the Earth's atmosphere, and they are slowly depleting ozone worldwide. And, you know, it's maybe 3, 4, 5% lower now than it was 10 years ago. It doesn't sound like a lot, but all you need is a 1% decrease to cause supposedly a 4% increase in skin cancer and, you know, biological consequences. It doesn't take a lot. More research is needed on all that. We'll talk about that later. But, so it's slowly depleting the global ozone, but it's very rapidly depleting ozone in the polar regions, especially at certain times of year, due to natural meteorological conditions there. In the polar regions, it's so cold that you can actually get clouds forming in the stratosphere, way up, you know, twice as high as normal clouds, up in the ozone layer where you don't normally get clouds. They're very beautiful clouds. They're called mother-of-pearl clouds, nacreous clouds, all different colors. Got some pictures of them on this tape here. And these clouds provide crystal surfaces on which you get chemical reactions that greatly speed up the release of the chlorine and the bromine from these man-made chemicals. So that's why it's so bad at the poles. And now this is back to this business about the stratosphere cooling off, which I said would connect with the ozone problem. If you cool off the stratosphere, that means you're going to get more of these clouds in the stratosphere, maybe beyond just the polar regions where it's already cold naturally. If we start cooling off the stratosphere by warming up the troposphere, the lower part of the atmosphere, we could get, it won't be just polar stratospheric clouds anymore. It won't just have a polar ozone holes anymore. It could spread to the rest of the world. Another thing you want to sort of keep an eye on is there's an effort afoot now to build an SST, you know, a very fast jet. And it's sophisticated technology. They want to burn hydrogen, which is my fuel of choice for the future. It makes water as the exhaust, which seems benign. However, if you release a lot of water in the stratosphere, see, the reason why you don't normally get clouds in the stratosphere is because it's so dry there. But if it's cold enough, as it is at the poles, even with very dry conditions, you can condense out water into clouds. But now, what if we make it not so dry by starting to fly fleets of SSTs around in the stratosphere, releasing water vapor all over the place, seemingly harmless water vapor? Now you're going to maybe get more stratospheric clouds, which again, through this special chemistry, greatly speed up the reactions that release the chlorine and the bromine from these man-made chemicals. So you've got to watch out for that. I mean, people talk about how the space shuttle, there's all this thing about the space shuttle releasing chlorine in the strat. How many people have heard about that? Gosh, not too many then. Well, the space shuttle does release chlorine into the atmosphere and the stratosphere on its way up. Again, a lot of it, most of it is in the form of hydrogen chloride, which is soluble. It's also a fairly inert reservoir molecule. It locks up the chlorine in HCl, which keeps the chlorine out of trouble. What you need is a bare chlorine. Does get released ultimately as chlorine, which destroys ozone. It's just that the amounts that ultimately become pure chlorine from the space shuttle are really insignificant compared to industrial sources. You have to increase the launch rate of space shuttles by about a factor of 100 before you begin to make a dent comparable to what we've been doing with our commercial chemicals. But the SST might be a different matter, and at NASA there's actually an effort going on in conjunction with the most recent ozone expeditions to study just the effect of SSTs. High-speed research plane project, what we call it. All right, was this clear about this, how the infrared gets trapped and all that stuff? Okay, now, so I just talked about the natural greenhouse effect. What we're doing and what all the fuss is about now is that we're adding yet more greenhouse gases to the lower atmosphere, namely carbon dioxide, the big one, responsible for half of the expected global warming. The CFCs, the chlorofluorocarbons, responsible for a quarter of the expected greenhouse warming. And then nitrous oxide, or laughing gas, and methane, or natural gas, and a few others, but those are the main ones. And these are all actually much more potent than carbon. Well, the carbon dioxide is the most prevalent, but the CFCs per molecule are 10,000 times more efficient at absorbing and re-radiating infrared, and the methane is about 20 times more efficient than carbon dioxide. So even though there's less of those around, you get more bang per molecule in terms of greenhouse effect. So the question is, all right, what do we do to get away from these things? And I talked a lot about this on Monday already, about solar energy. The whole point of moving towards solar renewable energy is because you don't generate pollution. I mean, there's some pollution certainly generated in manufacturing the solar cells and the equipment that you need and the infrastructure and all that, but it's nothing compared to what we're doing now. By the way, I should say, I don't think I made this point very well last Monday. By solar, well, I did say this, by solar I don't mean just sun shining on things. I also mean wind and water power. The correct term for all these is renewable. It's energy that keeps coming in for free or that you can grow back, like biomass, which harnesses photosynthesis, the sun's energy. But what I didn't say is, well, why is wind and water power considered solar? Well, what makes the wind? The wind?
Heating.
Yeah, the wind comes from uneven heating of the earth by the sun. And as I pointed out Monday, even that thunderstorm was really, the lightning in that thunderstorm is ultimately solar energy. It's caused by the convection from, the uneven heating and towering clouds and water and ice particles going around, separating charge and eventually giving the lightning. And then water. Why is water solar? You think, well, gosh, it's water falling. That's gravity. That doesn't have anything to do with the sun. But the question is, how did the water get up there in the first place? And as the cool school kids say, it's evaporation, condensation, precipitation. So it's the evaporation that gets it up there. That's solar. So, that's the long and short of the ultimate solution to the greenhouse effect. But let's see here. What do we want to talk about? Yeah, just want to, Yeah, I want to compare and contrast these things in just a couple of other ways here and then just open it up for discussion. We'll show you the videotape too. With CFCs, it's going to be easier than with carbon dioxide and the greenhouse effect. I mean, it's a more urgent, critical problem which could kill us in the next 50 years if we really lost a lot of ozone. And we don't really know what's going to happen, and we don't really know what the biological effects are. About only 1 or 2% of all the money spent on research on the ozone problem has been the kind of stuff I'm involved with, flying the airplanes around, trying to figure out what's going on and the sort of the physics and chemistry of it. But unfortunately, not much is known about the biology. I mean, it's known that soybeans, which are one of the crops I hold out as good for the future of the world, for, a sustainable diet for the Earth's people, they are unfortunately very sensitive to increased ultraviolet, as is rice and many other crops. I mean, it's not just skin cancer we're talking about here, or cataracts, or damaged immune systems, which could lead to epidemics of diseases, and that alone is serious enough. But the plankton, the marine phytoplankton, I just learned this recently, the marine phytoplankton in the oceans are half of the world's biomass. Half of the living matter in the Earth is the marine phytoplankton. And in the Antarctic, already just in the last couple of years, it's now been seen that
their reproductive rate is down by 10%. And this is thought to be almost certainly due to the increased ultraviolet, which is being received in the Antarctic region now. I mean, they're getting summer levels of ultraviolet down there, you know, in the dead of winter. I mean, parts of the South Pole region, you don't get any light at all, but, you know, that's, you know, out a little bit farther away, you do get some light. And even with that very minimal light in the dead of winter, you're getting summer levels of ultraviolet. And, you know, well, you know, that's light that it gets some time of the year. It's nothing out of the ordinary. It's just that, you know, life isn't evolved to have this kind of timing problem with the way the light is coming.
The decrease in the ozone, 25%, is 35% decrease in the point.
Yeah. It's hard to study this in the lab because there's so many other factors that come in, escape routes for organisms out in nature. The other significant biological effect that I've heard from reputable sources is the cactus plants, the saguaro cactus plants in Arizona. Have you heard about this one? I mean, they were an endangered enough stand as it is. These are the ones that, you know, look like the, you know, this, you hang a hat on them and all that. I've never seen these things. I better go see them soon because, I mean, they were already in trouble due to the encroachment of man, but now a bunch of them have been seen to be developing this tough brown flesh on their south-facing sides, and then they lose their spines and die. And the fact that it's on the south-facing sides strongly implicates something in the sunlight, because in the northern hemisphere, the sun shines in from the south. A good candidate for what that might be is increased ultraviolet. There's some people who are doing some experiments right now. They're going to be putting these big glass sleeves around some of these plants. I'm not sure exactly how these things look. I would imagine they probably leave them enough air room to, you know, interact with bugs and things that they normally, you know, you want to keep everything else as constant as you can, but you want to screen out excess ultraviolet with these glass sleeves and see if it makes a difference. And then there are reports of lichens up in the far north and all kinds of other things. But again, the biology, we really need a lot more research. If anybody in here is interested in going and studying biology, I can't encourage you enough to, that this is a great application for it. It could take you to some very exotic places, too. How do we get on to all this here? We've got an easy time, though, relatively, with the ozone problem because, okay, I said it was critical and urgent and could kill us. But it's a relatively narrow set of chemicals that are involved that are a small part of our economy. I mean, as you all probably know, it's the freons used in refrigeration and air conditioning and as blowing agents for plastic foams and great solvents for clean computer chips and also the halons used as fire retardants that are miraculously effective in fighting electrical and oil fires. Okay? I mean, we can find substitutes for these things and that is being done. They're more expensive, maybe not as effective, although the more effort and money we put into it, I'm pretty confident we can find other substitutes. And in fact, just completely different processes. Have you all heard about the sonic refrigerators? You know, it may well be that in the next decade or two, refrigerators will use sound waves, the compression and rarefaction of sound waves to refrigerate. No chemicals at all. And there are various problems. There's another kind of refrigeration, thermoelectric, which uses the boundaries between semiconductors to cool things off. And so there are other completely different ways of doing things. And of course, IBM and DEC, Digital Equipment Corporation, came up with a completely different way of cleaning their computer chips, basically a high-tech dishwasher, hot deionized water and heat. And, you know, they probably would have used that from the beginning if they hadn't had these chemical companies hawking these fancy products to them, you know, and didn't realize that there was any problem at that time. But now that they do, they've found a better way. But anyway, this is relatively easy. I mean, it's going to be hard, okay? It's a multi-billion dollar industry, and I'll tell you, it's been pulling teeth, to say the least, for the last several decades, couple decades, to get people to come around and realize we've got to do something. But still, it's also, the reason why it's easy is that, well, we may be in trouble for 100 years or so. You may see a lot of more skin cancer and other problems and havoc with the environment. But the atmosphere will, if we begin to phase out these chemicals, which we are already, quite rapidly actually, the atmosphere will heal itself maybe in 100 or 200 years. Sounds like a long time, but that's nothing compared to what we're facing with the greenhouse effect if we let that juggernaut loose. And the other main way in which I have to contrast these is that there's good news on the ozone thing and that we have the international agreements that have been forged in recent years to get rid of the offending chemicals within 10 or 15 years. On the greenhouse effect, unfortunately,
Well, there's some good news there too, actually. Most of the rest of the world seems to be hip to it now, and they are intending to go in the right direction. But the biggest polluter of all, the United States, completely has its head in the ground on this, and we're going in the dead wrong direction. Now, hopefully, we'll see a change. George Bush is the candidate of change. I say he's the candidate of global climate change. But anyway, let's have a change, yeah. And maybe we'll go in a different direction. But speaking of these timescales, this is an interesting thing. Gosh, how much time do we have? Oh, well, another 15 minutes, right? Yeah. This is kind of a pleasant little thing here, just a little bit of astronomy, something I love, and it's very interesting. I want to show you something about just how the carbon cycle works, because what we're concerned with, there are these other greenhouse gases, but let's consider carbon dioxide, the big one. What happens to that in the atmosphere? And this will allow us a comparison of the other, our two sister brother planets, Mars and Venus, and understand a little bit about planetary atmospheres. So let's see what we can do here. This is to give you an idea of how long the time scale of carbon in the atmosphere is. Once you overload the atmosphere with carbon, it takes a lot longer time to get rid of it. I mean, we're talking thousands to millions of years compared to those mere hundreds with the chlorofluorocarbons. I mean, the chlorofluorocarbons are amazingly persistent. You put them up there, it takes them 10 or 20 years to work their way up there, and then they stay there for a century or more. That's why, you know, we're only seeing the leading edge of the ozone problem right now. We're only seeing the results of the releases of CFCs through, you know, 1960s or so. The last couple decades haven't even begun to come back to haunt us yet. So it's going to get worse before it gets better. But at least it may start really getting better in a couple centuries. However, with carbon dioxide, we better start reforming our ways as soon as possible. Gosh, well, I don't know if you can read this, but let's see. You can at least see the picture, I guess, pretty well, huh? The idea here is that there's sort of a natural feedback process that keeps the Earth's temperature in balance over very long time scales. I have to point out at the outset, though, that what we're talking about, see, is overloading the atmosphere with carbon dioxide on a scale of the next 50 to 100 years too fast for this thing to compensate for, okay? So this is not really relevant to what we might do to the environment. I mean, the Earth has seen widely fluctuating levels of carbon dioxide over millions of years. Back in the days of the dinosaurs, the Earth was, you know, 8 or 10 degrees warmer than it is now. So why are we worried about global warming? Life clearly existed then. It's just that it didn't have to adapt to a change of that magnitude within a century. It had millions of years to deal with it. And, you know, trees can't just get up and run to climates that they like better, that are cooler, and, you know, animals can't migrate across all of mankind's fences and roads and all this kind of stuff. So, but anyway, on the longer term scale, let's relax a little bit here and just look at how carbon cycles through the atmosphere. It's kind of neat. You've probably heard of the Gaia principle, and the idea there is that the Earth is sort of a living organism whose biota, whose biomass, has evolved in harmony, and it modulates the climate so that if the Earth gets too hot, well, then you have more plants growing, which love carbon dioxide. They suck some carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, which tends to cool it down a little bit. If the Earth gets too cold, well, then maybe it's too cold for plants. You don't have quite as many plants growing, so you don't have as much carbon dioxide sucked out of the atmosphere, so more can build up from other sources, and it'll warm it back up again. But actually, you don't even need the plants to explain a balance in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. You can do it completely with what's called the carbonate silicate cycle, and it certainly is a very important component. I mean, the plants are important too. It's not really known exactly what percentage each is responsible for, but this is probably the lion's share of it. The way it works is we've actually got continental drift involved here. What happens is you've got carbon dioxide in the air, the rain falls, dissolves it, washes it out into the land. It interacts there with silicate and calcium chemicals. You end up with calcium carbonate in the ocean, you know, seashells, shells of organisms. And again, you wouldn't even have to have life if you got enough of this stuff concentrated in the ocean, even without organisms. The stuff would just precipitate out. But you eventually get your carbon out of the atmosphere down onto the ocean floor. And then with plate tectonics, you know, continental drift, you get your plate sliding around, subducting under continents. That carries the carbon deep into the Earth, where it then is subjected to high temperatures and pressures and re-vented into the atmosphere through volcanoes. So then it comes back in the atmosphere. So that's the cycle. And what's interesting is that on Mars, see, there's this Goldilocks problem in the study of the solar system. Why is Mars too cold and Venus too hot and the Earth just right? Well, I mean, you might think that the answer is just that, well, Mars is farther away, Venus is closer to the sun.
But actually, it turns out that they are all within what's called the continuously habitable zone. They all could have climates hospitable to life. And in fact, at one time, there most probably was abundant water on Mars and abundant water on Venus. I mean, there's a smoking gun of plenty of good geological evidence for oceans and lakes and streams on Mars. I'm on a computer network of teachers and students nationwide. These kids, you know, send their questions to the scientist online, you know, and one of them was, are there rivers in outer space? And I tell them, I love that question, you know. There probably were once rivers on Mars, and I'm sure there are elsewhere. And in fact, we will probably, in the next couple decades, discover fossil life forms on Mars. And anyway, it's kind of interesting. But why, okay, so why, if, you know, they're in this inhabitable zone, why are they so different now? What went wrong on Venus and on Mars? Answer is that each of them had only half of this cycle, and they had a different half of it. Venus lost the half where there was rain falling to get it out of the atmosphere, and Mars lost the half where it was being pumped back into the atmosphere. The reason why Mars lost that half is because Mars is considerably smaller than the Earth. It's too small to have the hot interior that gives rise to the continental drift. So Mars is geologically a kind of inert planet, so it doesn't have continental drift, it doesn't have it does have the biggest volcano in the solar system, okay? It's got that Mons Olympus, that 15-mile high monster. But at some point, it just kind of ground to a halt. And all of its carbon that it started out with in its atmosphere ended up locked in its rocks. I mean, there was water and it did get rained into the rocks, but at some point it stopped being repumped into the atmosphere. On Venus, it's kind of the opposite. Venus still has volcanoes. It looks like the Magellan is actually showing us some evidence of these things, the Magellan spacecraft that's out there. But it's lost its water because it was too hot there, for one thing. I mean, that really is just because it was too close to the sun. But it did have water, and it was having a cycle like this. But what happened there was that the volcanoes kept pumping all the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Eventually, it stopped raining out as water disappeared. So now all its carbon dioxide is in the atmosphere. All of Mars's is in the ground. And now here's the interesting thing about how this, you can tweak this feedback to keep things in balance. On Earth, you've got both halves, and it works beautifully to keep the atmosphere in balance over the very long term, because what happens if the Earth gets too cold? If it gets too cold, you don't get as much evaporation from the ocean, you don't get as much rain coming down, you don't get as much carbon dioxide washed out of the atmosphere. But yet you still have the same stuff being pumped in. So carbon dioxide will slowly build up in the atmosphere, make things warmer. On the other hand, what happens if the Earth's atmosphere gets too hot? Well, you'll get more evaporation of water vapor, more rain out of carbon dioxide, and only the same amount of pumping in. So you'll be taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. That will tend to cool things back off. Isn't that neat? That's pretty neat. And Mars and Venus each only have different one-halves of that cycle. The Earth is such a beautiful place, you know, why mess it up? Now, speaking of the greenhouse effect, there are all these uncertainties we can talk about. One of the biggest ones is the role of clouds. If you evaporate a lot of water out of the oceans, well, there are a couple things that can happen. You can form a lot more clouds, which will then screen out incoming solar radiation, which could actually compensate and, you know, cool things off. On the other hand, you also end up with a lot more water vapor in the atmosphere. Remember what we said about water vapor? That's a very potent greenhouse gas. So it's really not known what direction these things are going to go, but you know, chances are when you start throwing a monkey wrench into a finely tuned, delicately balanced system, you're going to be in for some rude surprises. And the ultimate bottom line of all this, and I guess you know, a whole couple of lectures could be devoted to this, the line you're being fed by the government and the media is that, well, we shouldn't take costly measures, especially when they might be unnecessary because it might not even be a problem. You know, there are scientists that doubt how much of a problem it's going to be and all this stuff. Well, all right, the answer to that is, what do you mean costly measures? Let's just look at the measures that are being proposed to deal with this, shall we? Let's see whether they're really costly. Okay, the four things I can think of right off the bat to forestall global warming. I mean, I maintain at the outset, all right, that they are actually extremely beneficial, healthy to our economy, would drastically revitalize the American economy, all of them. I mean, they will cost something up front, but there is such a thing as cost-benefit analysis, which these folks aren't telling you about. What about the benefit side of the equation, okay? Let's look at that. All right, the first one is to get rid of chlorofluorocarbons. Well, there's another whole reason to do that, because that they are, you know, bad for ozone, okay? That's easy enough. Next one is to stop cutting down forests so fast that they can't grow back. You understand the connection there, right? Because if you lose your plants, which suck out carbon dioxide, then it's going to be allowed to build up more. And furthermore, when you burn forests, which is quite often done after they're clear cut, you release more carbon into the atmosphere, so you get a double whammy. All right, there are plenty of reasons why we shouldn't, you know, deforest too fast. I mean, erosion and floods and, you know, altering the local climate and just the beautiful, you know, aesthetic virtues and wilderness values of forest land. So, okay, what's the next one? Moving towards energy efficiency. You know, not so much by just freezing in the dark and, you know, altering our lifestyles and repenting for our sins. I mean, there's plenty of that could be done, I guess, but I'm talking about just smarter technology that does the same with far less energy, such as these new compact fluorescent light bulbs you're probably hearing about that, you know, do the same light for half the energy. No reason why, you know, governments and office buildings shouldn't be really moving to these things in a big way right now. And countless other examples, electric motors, you know, tremendous savings out there in energy efficiency. These are things which will cost something. The technology is expensive. You buy one of these compact fluorescent bulbs, it's very expensive up front, but over the life of the bulb, you save money hand over fist. It's so efficient that you know, it lasts so much longer than a regular bulb, and you use so much less electricity. The whole problem is that initial cash flow problem. People can't see their way clear to fronting the money to buy this, but once you buy it, man, you're in there. And the same is true of all these solar technologies. They cost something up front, but once we've got them, we're on our way. And all these guys, our so-called leaders, tell you about is the cost of these measures. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the benefits of them, and let's really nail them on that. What do you mean, costs? I mean, how much is it going to cost us when the Swedes and the Germans and the Japanese develop and perfect these technologies, which many of them, which we invented, and then they sell us all this stuff when our market is ripe for it in 10 years? Where are the jobs going to be then? How much is that going to cost the economy? So,
well, do you think part of the problem is some industrialists don't want us to be saving money down the line? They want us to be pushing their product?
Well, I mean, there's one understandable thing about this, and that is that a lot of big businesses have invested a lot of money in the present way we do things, and they need to recover that investment. That's understandable. But now when you talk about the White House pushing hard to drill for oil in the Arctic National Wildlife Reserve and off the west coast of the U.S. and calling this the foundation of America's energy future, when, you know, the whole amount of oil out there might be enough to keep us going for, I don't know, a few months or something. It's totally ridiculous. And it seems to me, frankly, to just be the highest officer in the land using his position to prop up the interests of his fat cat buddies in the oil business.
Short-term profit.
And so anyway, we got to call a spade on this. We got to raise hell about this stuff and call for what the world really needs. So, I don't know if anybody disagrees with this, please let me know. I don't like to preach to the converted. I like to talk with people who disagree with me and who can, you know, that I can learn from, or that we can all learn from. But, so, I don't know if that answers your question. I mean, I think there is, pretty soon, and also there's just an appalling ignorance about this stuff. I mean, I've been trying to convince people that, I mean, I'm talking about the election, okay? And, well, I mean, I'm not enamored of either candidate, but at least Clinton is talking a good line about solar energy, renewable energy, energy efficiency, modern transportation things. The other good thing that I like about him is he puts a priority on education. You know, you say, well, look at Arkansas's education. Well, he started in a really miserable state, and he's actually done quite well by Arkansas's education system. He's still got a long way to go. But education and environment alone, just for those two really big, really important things, he gets my vote. I mean, I am going to vote, and I'm going to vote for one of the two mainstream people, and it's going to be him. The other thing he puts priority on that Bush obviously doesn't is the poor. And, you know, how is he going to pay for it, and blah, blah, blah. You can get into all kinds of details, but I have to go with the main values. Quayle's the guy who keeps talking about values. Well, there, if I had one word for the values that the last 12 years of the White House has brought the American public and really honed to an art, it's extreme selfishness. That's their values. But anyway, so... But there's just an appalling ignorance about the potential of this stuff. I try to tell people that this stuff could revitalize the American economy, and it really gets me excited. And they say, well, maybe for you, you know, solar, you know, here's some granola-chomping hippie here, you know. I tell you, if we don't do it, the Japanese and the Germans and the Swedes are going to do it, and they're going to be rich, and they're going to not be polluting the planet, and we'll sort of be, you know, drowning in our own pollution, I guess. So we might as well get on with it, and we might as well just learn everything we can about the potentials here.
And I'm sure there's plenty more than the stuff I laid out Monday and the few things I mentioned today. I mean, where there's a will, there's a way. The great problem in this country is it just seems we're too fat and lazy to have much of a will anymore. We're spoiled. Oh, by the way, while I'm sermonizing, I wanted to say something at the beginning, which I thought was kind of neat. You know, I was wondering about the far future of mankind. What would it be like? And, you know, if we ever manage to meet or get signals from or actually converse somehow with advanced civilizations that have succeeded for millions of years and have been around a lot longer than we have and have managed to surmount the great problems of living, well, we'll probably learn some very interesting things about science and technology from them, but maybe one of the most important things we'll learn from them is basically just how to get along with each other, how to take care of each other. And the things that they will say will probably sound a lot like the words of Jesus Christ. I mean, Jesus Christ was light years ahead of his time. But you know, that's what I tell people is, you know, what would you hear from aliens? I maintain that one of the main things we hear from them, if they are really advanced and have succeeded in sticking around and not killing themselves off by any number of methods for a long time, they'll probably sound a lot like Jesus. You know, the message of love and active, hard love and caring for each other, and that's where it's really at. And, you know, caring for the creation, and that's what we're talking about here. So, more questions. I forgot to say all kinds of things, and there are all sorts of neat nuances of all this, so.
If, as a consumer, I want to find out about how to find out if these kind of light bulbs, and how do I find out about what types of things I can incorporate into my household that are energy efficient. What's the best way to learn about?
Gosh, the best way. There are tons of books and publications and leaflets and things flying around out there all over the place. I'm sure Al has this building stocked high with all kinds of leaflets. I think I saw something out there in compact fluorescent light bulbs. I don't know, Al could probably answer that question better than I. There's plenty of literature, but it's interesting that you asked that, though, that it's just not out there. It's information
that... Part of it is that it's not broadcast or advertised in the media, and through the places where you don't have to make an effort.
Well, I don't know. There have
been...
And
I honestly have not made the effort.
There have been things occasionally in, you know, Newsweek or Time, even about these new bulbs, I think, and occasional articles on energy efficiency. But I guess, you know, given the... tremendous.
Well, I get these bulbs and take them to church, and I get the all the kind of saving devices for toilets and water, and you know, hot water saves the energy and all that stuff, and take them to church.
Yeah,
and you could do the same. I can provide you with sources for all this stuff.
That's actually the answer to your question. The best way to find out is to find people who are already plugged into it, and just let them plug in. Let them turn you on to this stuff. That's the way I operate. I hate reading stuff. I'm tired of reading. I read like 19 words a minute. I'm just too tired. My brain thinks too much and bounces around between the lines. And so I talk better and listen better to people. And so
we actually have an Earth Center store on State Street in Chicago now.
Really?
So maybe you should start a
That's
store.
That's where my speed is. Like,
are you in Chicago?
No, but I know that if I
maybe I should start a business.
Yeah,
there are stores too. Yeah, there are.
Well, the other thing is that what kind of are there companies that are out there that are trying to push these types of products but are being pushed out, say, by the big business? That we could target to try to help.
Let's see. There are some who actually are doing pretty well. They just aren't widely known yet. There are actually some mutual funds that you can invest in too, which most of their investments, they have a portfolio of investments in, you know, environmentally progressive businesses and things. And the New Alternatives Fund based in New York mostly invests in renewable energy efficiency, things like that. A whole bunch of those. But as far as businesses, well, let's see, one example I pointed out in the talk on Monday. How many people were here Monday? So only four, so I'm not duplicating too much. A couple of big businesses have recently come up with an innovation, a new kind of solar cell, you know, the photovoltaic panel. I'm going to try to talk Holden into getting a couple of these. They're worried about what they're going to do for electricity up here this winter because the snowpack is bad up there. They're going to have very reduced stream flow, and all their electricity depends on that stream flow. I think it's time that, I mean, for a priori reasons anyway, just because it would be a neat, interesting project, though expensive, but especially for things like this, to get a bank of photovoltaic panels where the sunlight hits it and you generate electricity. And of course, you need a battery to store it for when the sun's not out there, but they don't even need direct sunlight. They'll work with diffuse sunlight. And although the sun only makes it over the gap here for a couple hours in the winter, you, on a clear day, you get a whole day's worth of diffused sunlight. Anyway, those cells have been expensive until just recently. Well, I mean, it's semiconductor technology, and we all know how the costs of that are coming down. But now they've got this new thing called solar sandpaper. It hasn't really come to market yet, but Texas Instruments and Southern California Edison invented this new process that uses a cheaper metallurgical grade of silicon formed into tiny spheres embedded in a mesh of aluminum foil. And it's hoped that in, you know, 3 or 4 years, half the houses in Southern California will have these things on the rooftops, you know, supplying maybe a third of their electricity needs. And, well, I don't know if they're going to be pushed out of the market. This whole thing came from a mere $10 million investment, which is a drop in the bucket, you know.
So,
yeah.